Hello and welcome to the Arc of Crisis podcast from the NATO Association of Canada. This is Shah Lalapet, research analyst and your host. Our guest today is Mr. Andrew Carswell. He currently serves as the senior delegate to Canada for the International Committee of the Red Cross, or the ICRC as it's popularly known. This interview with Mr. Carswell was conducted in December 2016. And it is presented to you in the light of the targeted attack that took place quite recently in Afghanistan, in February 2017. The attack took the lives of 6 staff members and left 2 unaccounted for. The ICRC has put out an appeal statement requesting the unconditional release of the 2 unaccounted staff members believed to be abducted. They were all on their way, much like the thousands of ICRC staff members, to deliver much-needed aid. So through this podcast, Mr. Carswell and I will bring you into the historical and very current functions of the ICRC. We will discuss the international humanitarian law that it strives to uphold. We will also discuss the challenges that it faces while providing aid. We will further speak on specific issues like the refugee crisis and the gender-based violence. For ease of listening, I divided this interview into 2 parts, so please be sure to check out the second one after you finish the first part. Now, before we dive into the interview, I would like to take a moment to mention that this podcast was made possible by the contributions of our sponsor, Ports Toronto. For more information about our presenting sponsor, please visit portstoronto.com. Mr. Carswell, welcome to the interview. Now let's begin. Would you please give us a broad understanding of the International Committee of the Red Cross, as well as its relationship to international humanitarian law?
Sure. Well, the International Committee of the Red Cross is the part of the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement that's focused on armed conflicts and other situations of violence worldwide. So we're actually located in around 80 countries around the world. Canada is one small presence of about 15,000 employees worldwide, with our headquarters in Geneva. And the ICRC's mandate is to protect and assist the victim, and also to strive to create an environment that's conducive to respect for international humanitarian law. This is the body of law, the Geneva Conventions, additional protocols and such, which protect various categories of individuals during armed conflict, and we are the custodians of that body of law in the sense that we actually convened the parties to the First Geneva Convention back in 1864, and for the last 150 years plus have been protecting that body of law and working to protect and assist those victims.
Now, would you please tell us a little bit more about ICRC Canada and your position in the organization?
I've been in this position for about a year and a half myself. Before that, I was based in some other contexts. The position itself has only been around for about 5 years. So this is a function of Canada's role in the world. It has to do with the fact that Canada is now one of our major donors. At ICRC, it's a top 10 donor of the organization. But, of course, we do all of our basic work with Canada that we do with other governments, meaning that we have a dialogue with Global Affairs Canada. We have a dialogue with Foreign Affairs, with Defense, regarding their obligations under the Geneva Conventions. We, of course, have a dialogue regarding the operations that are happening in the world today. What's our read of the humanitarian situation, and where does Canada fit into that? So sometimes it's just generic. Other times it's much more on the confidential bilateral platform if we're talking about specific issues that we wish to deal with.
Now, if I may ask you, I would like to know about your specific duties and what is it that you go through on a day-to-day basis?
Well, as a delegate here in Ottawa, I'm working frequently with the government, having a dialogue with them about the humanitarian situation worldwide. I'm bringing in visitors from Geneva, and what we're trying to do is take advantage of the fact that Canada, in its outreach to the world, is projecting itself in terms of compliance with international humanitarian law. We are separate from that dialogue, but we're encouraging countries like Canada, who have a strong record on compliance with the law and inducing compliance with the law, to try to get them to continue to do that or to increase the reach when it comes to ensuring the respect of other parties, including those that they would train or those that they work alongside.
So what are the factors that were at play to have a permanent base of the ICRC in Canada? Was it a matter of Canada being one of the largest donors to ICRC, or was it a sense of higher responsibility that maybe brought Canada to this position?
The government of Canada is a strong donor to ICRC, but it didn't decide to put an office here. So that was a decision that was made by the International Committee of the Red Cross in Geneva and on the basis of Canada's position in the world today. So it was a decision that was made by ICRC itself pertaining to its relationship with the government of Canada. Yeah.
Can you describe in short, what are the various aspects of training that our armed forces go through when they get deployed?
Every armed force in the world has a different way of doing this. The Canadian Armed Forces have a very robust system of training, international humanitarian law. Mm-hmm. Every officer, for example, and senior non-commissioned member in the Canadian Forces goes through a training on laws of armed conflict, and all those who are implicated in operations have some sort of law of armed conflict training. This is something that's their own responsibility to themselves, but we will get involved, for example, in providing realistic scenarios for them. For example, we do some work with the operational law course that they give to their young legal advisors, to their uniformed legal advisors, their JAG officers, as they're called. They will go into situations where they have a dialogue with the International Committee of the Red Cross on a particular issue. So we might have a fictional scenario in which there's been an attack, and we're providing a picture of that attack from the civilian population to the armed forces. And these young lawyers are there to say, okay, this is the law that applies, and to have a discussion with us on the other side. And as is always the case, when we talk with armed forces, we come from slightly different perspectives. They come from the perspective of, of course, they're worried about civilian protection, but they're very much worried about force protection, about the young women and men that they put in harm's way. On our side, of course, we've been around for 150 years as an organization, but working really from the lens of the victims of armed conflict. So sometimes when we bring these things together, it creates some friction in the way in which we interpret the law. The law itself is already a compromise between these two things of military necessity and humanity, and then the way in which it's interpreted also takes you in those directions. So it's always an interesting discussion to have, and young lawyers should understand that dynamic. Operators equally need to understand the dynamic because they're the ones who ultimately pull the trigger in the field.
So what are some of the initiatives that you run the moment you go into a conflicted area to deliver aid?
The first thing is the aid itself. So that this comes in the form of water projects, in terms of habitation projects, dealing with IDP populations, internally displaced persons. You have various agencies that are going to be working concurrently, so we have to coordinate with them and make sure that we're not stepping on each other's toes. For example, when it comes to refugees, you have the UN High Commissioner for Refugees as an organization, which is primarily in charge of those issues. But, you know, in a refugee camp, you might have a Restoring Family Link Station, which is run by International Committee of the Red Cross, because that's a fundamental part of what we do. So we make sure that individuals are able to take contact with their families. That can be via telephone, cell phone even, or if that's not possible, it can be via a Red Cross message, which is written out, handed to us, and then we'll hand it over to the National Society of X country, and they'll go on a motorcycle up to the tribal areas of Pakistan and drop off this message to somebody who is otherwise inaccessible. So that's a very, you know, very positive aspect of it. We go in and work with the detention facilities, meet with the detaining authorities in relation to an armed conflict. So we look at the detainees who are picked up in the conflict, and we again frame our dialogue with them in terms of international law and go through those things. We also have a dialogue with the parties on the conduct of operations. We'll go back and forth with the local commanders and talk to them about how they're being perceived by the civilian population and how they can improve their conduct of operations. So that's on the protection side, and then on the assistance side, you've got, as mentioned, your basics, your food packs, your non-food items, everything from cutlery to oil to the things that will allow a family to sustain itself in the short and medium term. And then also we get involved in microeconomic initiatives for the longer term. So these things are happening concurrently. We're making sure that people are protected who are vulnerable. We're also making sure that the population is receiving the basics of life, the food, the water, the shelter that they need, medical assistance, and so on. And where we can, we're going to employ the local government to provide all these services. We're not there to substitute ourselves for them. We rather try to reinforce what the government is doing and to identify gaps and to try to fill those gaps alongside the government.
How do you go about educating or implementing adherence to international law to groups of people around the world that honestly may not even know of its existence? While they might be staunch followers of the laws of their land, how do you bring them to conform to the international standards?
The way we look at it, so in my previous role, up until a year ago, I was working in ICRC's unit for relations with arms carriers. We look at it from the perspective of who is pulling the trigger, what's the humanitarian problem, and how do you reverse engineer from there? So you identify there's a particular humanitarian problem in a given conflict, and then you ask yourself the question, okay, who is responsible, and how can you either potentially or actually, sometimes it's more in the abstract, and who might be responsible for violations of the law, and then work your way backwards from there. So when we work with, first of all, when we come into a country, we have to make sure that they've ratified or acceded to the various treaties of international humanitarian law. So we have lawyers who go in and encourage states to sign on to these treaties, to ratify them, and then from there, very importantly, to take the provisions of those treaties and to domesticate them through an act, for example. Like Canada has a Geneva Conventions Act. So if a member of the Canadian Forces commits a violation of the Geneva Conventions, it's covered through that act, which is extremely important. It gives it teeth anywhere in the world. Once you've gotten past domestication, ratification, these sorts of things, and you've created the framework of law, you have delegates like myself who would come and talk to armed forces and who would work to integrate the law into their operational practice. Now, it used to be that we would talk to airplane hangars worth of battalions of troops about international law and international humanitarian law and try to change their perceptions about it. What we found, there was a very interesting study in 2004 called The Roots of Behavior in War. It was a psychological study commissioned by the ICRC. That study said that we might be able to change attitudes if we're very persuasive, but we're not going to change behavior because behavior is a function of orders, and orders will come in above any sort of perception you have as a soldier. The order is always going to be the prime thing. They can only refuse to obey by an order in cases where it's manifestly unlawful. So that being the case, we have to ask, where do the orders come from? Well, it begins at the strategic level, in terms of the way in which the Chief of Defense and the Minister of Defense have set the framework for that. It works its way through the doctrine system, to the education and training system, the education system in classrooms, the training system in the field, and then how is it reflected then in military justice and discipline? So all these things holistically come together, and you have to make sure that each and every one of them is adequately reflecting the law.
My next question is, what are your thoughts about recognized states, governments, that start disrespecting the laws of state sovereignty?
Any state that's getting involved in an armed conflict that raises issues under international law which are beyond the remit of what an international community Red Cross does. So we're not there to pronounce upon whether they should or shouldn't be getting involved in armed conflict. Rather, we're mitigating the effects of the conflict to the best effect that we can. But that having been said, when we see that proxy conflicts are going on, or where one party is supporting another party inside an armed conflict in a given country, we see that as an opportunity to work with the power that the state that's supporting, or it could be a non-state that's supporting a group inside a particular country. We see that as an opportunity to apply Common Article 1 of the Geneva Conventions, which says that you don't just have an obligation to respect international humanitarian law, you have an obligation to ensure respect. And ICRC understands that as working with those you are training, for example, to ensure that they abide by international humanitarian law.
And with that, we've come to the end of part one of our podcast. Please proceed to listen to part two, where we discuss, among other things, the actual challenges and hazards that aid workers face, how they deal with gender-based violence, and the interesting possibility of using UAVs in aid work. Thanks for listening. See you in part two.